Welcome to the Navit Gaming Podcast, where it is our mission to explore the business and future of video games. We bring together the industry's brightest builders, investors, and thinkers to keep a pulse on current events, dissect emerging trends in games, share lessons learned, and have a great time. This podcast is also part of Navit's growing ecosystem, which ranges from free and premium research to consulting and advisory services. For more information, visit www.navic.co. This episode is brought to you by NEFTA. NEFTA has created an advertising network that pays game publishers higher eCPMs on their iOS opt-out users and drives better results for advertisers. This works by delivering their campaigns to more receptive and relevant audiences using first-party data and behavioral analytics on an app-by-app basis. A simple two-step integration enables them to drive superior results for advertisers while increasing ARPDAU for publishers in a 100% privacy-compliant way. You can learn more about how NEFTA can boost your results at nefta.io. Now, let's jump into the episode.
Hello, and welcome to the Navit Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Ovori. We have a great episode for you today. Our topic is one of the most anticipated Web3 games of 2024. Guild of Guardians. They recently announced a pivot from real-time RPG to auto-battler, and Immutable also released a new white paper offering further insights into this pivot, particularly on the Web3 front. The game is in soft launch, set for a May 15th global release, so we wanted to assess the updated design of Immutable's second game, which is also one of the very first on its new ZK EVM blockchain. And in this episode, we also wanted to take a little pause, now that we're already a quarter of the way through the year, to evaluate where the Web3 gaming space really is. With a fresh crypto bull well underway, what does that mean for games? And have we learned any lessons from 2021, 2022? Or is it just tulip mania all over again? So to dive into all of this, we have Navic's very own Web3 analyst, Devin Becker, who just published an in-depth look at Guild of Guardians, which is a must read for anyone interested. And I also had Robbie Ferguson, who's the founder of Immutable, on the show on the January 24th episode, talking about the Immutable roadmap for 2024, which is definitely also worth a listen to get a sense of what one of the biggest ecosystem players is up to. And we'll put a link to both of those in the show notes. So with that, Devin, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me. Always great to talk to you. Definitely, you're staying on top of a lot of this stuff, so it's awesome to keep
all right,
having these conversations.
Right back at you. All right, let's get into it. And let's start, just like with the intro, let's start with Guild of Guardians. Why is it a big deal? What is it? And what are you seeing them doing that's interesting?
It's a big deal partially because there was only so many games that kind of survived this sort of big boom in 2021, 2022, when everyone got a lot of money and a lot of people just silently burnt out. And obviously big players like Immutable can't really afford to do that. And they've had to sometimes make big refocuses like they did with Gods Unchained, which I think was pretty successful. And so then they had to do the same thing here, which I think is a pretty big deal to have to make a big pivot, because the big downside of Web3 a lot of time, the way it was run, is you're getting people invested early. You're giving a lot of promises. You're putting out these white papers with all these design promises ahead of time. And then reality hits and you've got to pivot. And that's the case here with Guild of Guardians. They've got to make a little bit of an adjustment with people already invested in the game.
And it's not just a little pivot. We're going from a real-time RPG to an auto-battler, which is a very different type of gameplay, arguably a different player base entirely. Certainly in Web2, there surely is overlap, but it's not like a one-to-one. And so to your point, with all of these players already invested early on into a real-time RPG, what's the sentiment like? What's going on? And why these pivots? Why did they feel they needed to do something this major, drastic almost, in my opinion?
Yeah, it's definitely there will be people that are somewhat dissatisfied with this altogether. I mean, myself, like I would definitely have much preferred to play a real-time game. I'm not really into the auto-battler genre, although there's plenty of RPGs that have auto-battling as an option where you just auto-play, especially in the Asia markets. So it's like there is room for that sort of transition. However, that being said, like it's definitely a pretty big change just in the game in general. And I think that is going to be a struggle for them to do it, but it was one of those things that was necessary, because what basically happened, and of course they would know the details better than me because I'm going off of what they've said publicly, but they basically ran into a situation where it was really not looking realistic for the deadlines that they had to try and put the game out. Their partner was not really keeping up with what they needed to do to get the game releasable, because they'd had some alphas, they had stuff somewhat working, but it was just clearly not going to hit what they were trying to do. So they had to pick up a new partner. Now, whether it's coincidence or not, but this new partner, Mindloader, happens to be quite good at making auto-battler games, and this is their forte. It seemed like it also might have been a simplification in terms of trying to get the real-time combat into some sort of mode that they could make work, because it's not easy to make something like that, especially what they were trying to do was a squad-based system where you were switching characters, but also real-time. And what they were doing was very difficult to achieve reasonably, honestly. So they basically just pivoted that to being like, let's focus on the parts that are essential to Web3, which is getting different characters, forming up the party, and going through these dungeons. So they kept that core, but simplified the other parts so that Mindloader could basically help them hit those deadlines. And so far, they actually are following that roadmap that they gave, which was for a Q2 2024 release, which they're on target for right now. And it's a soft launch at the moment in Canada, so you can play it up there.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the actual changes. They have NFTs, obviously, and they have a single token economy, the GOG token, G-O-G. What changes did they make to those, and how do they play nice with the new game mode or the game's play style that they've pivoted into?
Essentially, what the overall changes are is to basically focus more on appealing to the Web2 audience and making the Web3s a little more optional. So they've kept the stuff that existed in there as still existing in there, just maybe isn't as important or as critical to the gameplay, where you're not dependent on having NFTs to be able to play, for example. They're not critical to the gameplay. They're just better. And we'll see if that ends up working out for them, but they definitely made it a lot more optional. They also simplified a lot of the economy stuff, which makes sense considering the complexity before and not really anyone figuring out a great game plan for how to run this sort of open economy stuff. So they basically simplified a lot of that down as well to probably make quite a bit more of it not on-chain. Although there's a lot of stuff they say in the white paper, for example, that NFTs this, NFTs that, where they don't really get into detail on what exactly will be there. They leave a lot of stuff vague, like the use of the term resources here and there without really defining what that means. So they definitely left still a lot open, which, given they've already pivoted once, seems like the smart play to be like, we're going to have to figure this out as we go. Obviously, they have some public display with that soft launch in Canada, but they did have the one interesting element that they kept, which was trying to go with merging being an important component around crafting and things like that, which, being a resource and economic driven game, is still going to be a part of that. We'll see how that works out, because that's also still not super well defined, but it's interesting.
And how do the Web2 and Web3 components work together now? I think in your piece for Novik in the Digest, you noted that the NFT holders could potentially be overpowering the Web2 players. And of course, pay to win is never popular with players in any genre of games. Doesn't matter if it's a real-time RPG or auto battle or anything else. What in your view has happened to the Web2 and Web3 modes, if you will, and how well do they jive with each other from a player perspective?
Right. It left themselves a little bit of a problem because they sold a bunch of character NFTs first, right? Where they're like, okay, we sold all these NFTs. We promised that these are going to be super important to playing. They have to have some value. But at the same time, like you said, they can't be totally pay to win. So they had to find a balance where it's like, okay, they're going to be a little bit better. We're not going to shy away from that. There is a reason to upgrade towards this path. There has to be some reason to justify doing this. But at the same time, like, you could still play as a free-to-play player and participate, and you don't have to touch the Web3 economy. But they're still giving additional benefits to the people that bought those founders level NFTs. So they're going to get additional stuff. Whereas people coming in later, you can basically do what I think a lot of games will do, which is take your characters in the game and then turn them in NFTs for a price. And they haven't been super clear on whether or not you are spending, say, for example, tokens to do that, or just holding them, or exactly that process in terms of costs, things like that, which I imagine they're actually going to have to adjust over time, because you're dealing with a supply that they're going to have to manage of NFTs. But they also set up a system where there's a reason to burn heroes and NFTs to get resources back and upgrade your heroes. But they basically designed it to be very similar to most gacha systems out there, which is around collecting things and then burning duplicates. But they just have this extra layer of when they become NFTs, then they're a little bit better, because of course that costs a little bit more maybe, and they're a little slightly more exclusive, but there's still reasons to burn the duplicates, and we'll see how high that goes. But it is definitely going to encourage a little bit of pay to win element, in the sense that, of course, NFTs are more likely to cost real money as opposed to just earning them through gameplay.
Yeah. And I think that also introduces a potential problem with the major platforms. If you want to be on mobile, Google, Apple, while they're loosening, obviously, their rules, and maybe loosening isn't quite the right word, they're defining, they're better defining their rules, let's put it that way, not loosening. And so it's always going to be a fine line with having NFTs and gacha systems and things like that. What do you see as the path that Immutable has here to get to mobile and to be as broad as a Web 2 game, right? And that, of course, is always the goal. And we're going to talk about that in a second more broadly. But the Web 2 piece needs to be super accessible, and super accessible means it has to be mobile, essentially. Yeah. So talk a little bit about that, and how are Immutable navigating that in your view?
I think there's two easy ways to approach, two rules of to approach it with. One is around the gambling sort of laws that Google was trying to define. And I imagine those probably apply to Apple at some point as well. And so I think it's just a good process to follow, which is that basically if you do anything where you're getting a random output, that random output should not be an NFT right then. And so they, I think, leave a little bit of wiggle room there by defining exactly why that's the case, meaning they don't want something of a dollar value potentially coming out of one of those boxes. Now, if you get something out of a loot box and then you can turn it into an NFT later, you're making a conscious choice knowing the exact financial value potentially of that thing when you make that conversion. And in that case, that's just a transaction that I think everyone's transparent on, and then it's not gambling anymore. So I think that's actually pretty easy to understand application of the rule, which is to say just make it so that people could turn things that they already know what they are into NFTs, but they could still get random things prior to that process. So they're doing that. Of course, you could get your gacha characters and then you could turn them into an NFT later. And I think that process makes it pretty straightforward. The other thing is making sure people get their cut. Now, that's more at Apple's side, which if you're making sure Apple gets their cut of things, they're generally not going to complain. And in this case, if you are basically getting or creating heroes through some process that still involves Apple getting a cut of that. Now, it's not going to be 100%, right? Because you might be upgrading heroes to NFTs that you didn't purchase in any way. You just earned through gameplay. But that's probably not going to be something that's a big problem. It's more, hey, if you paid to summon a character with a gacha and you give an Apple a 30% cut for that in-app purchase, they're not going to care as much that you turn that to an IAP and then that gets traded, because it's not duplicating itself. There's no breeding system outside of it where you're making more. It's just swapping hands, but they already got their 30% on that generation. And I think fair is fair. Now, obviously, Apple could disagree. The reviewers could be random. But I think if you apply those rules where make sure they get their money and make sure people know what they're getting, that's generally what these sort of common sense parts are about.
Let's talk about the token, the GOG token. It's an important part of this particular game. Not every game, of course, has a tokenized economy, open economy. Open economies are notoriously hard to control. We've talked about it many times on this podcast with various other games as well. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on how this single token model, it's both for utility and for governance. How do you see that playing out? And then I have a whole bunch of questions around security and how well having this kind of auto battler, which really is automated gameplay, essentially, that makes it much easier to grind for and to potentially manipulate through bots, token generation, token harvesting, token mining, whatever you want to call it. So let's talk a little bit about the single token model first, and then we're going to get into the security elements of how this actually works in real life.
Yeah, definitely. First off, I think the easy answer about the single token model is that I don't see a world in where it makes a lot of sense to have it both act as governance and as a utility token. That's like that idea of voting with your dollar. Like it's
right.
You're just two very different purposes. One, you are trying to use it as some sort of medium of exchange or store of value or whatever. And the other, you're trying to use it as something where you're basically holding a vote with it in it. There may be ways to like abstract that out slightly where you're not literally using the token to do it, but there's some other process that involves the token. But again, that just looks like you're buying votes essentially. And I've seen that in the past with many games that did have a governance token. They still were, if you could purchase that token, then you're purchasing a vote. And that doesn't really make sense. But to be fair, democracy hasn't really been figured out in the real world. So I don't expect video games to figure it out any sooner.
Dollars do vote technically, right? And Citizens United, the Supreme Court, famous Supreme Court,
right,
said corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money on essentially influence. Yeah. Dollars do vote here in this country, at least. But anyway, we digress.
Yeah, absolutely. But and that's going to be problematic, right? And they don't really get into that in the white paper. They leave it vague, like, yeah, it'll probably be used for some governance, but they leave it there because, again, no one's figured that out. No one's really had the model that really showed how that would work. Some of the models are even just basically treasury claims and not really governance. Like the Axie model was essentially similar to that in the first place. But as far as the rest of the utility goes, they're in a weird situation because they don't seem to want people to actually really truly spend the token. They just want people to hold it for different reasons, meaning holding it to be able to maybe mint more NFTs or holding it in terms of staking it to get more of the token. So they don't seem to have any like real way to drive people to spend it. And that's the part that concerns me, because in a system like where you're generating tokens or providing supply over time, now they have their supply chart and stuff like that. Obviously they'd plan that ahead of time. This is not like a new token. It's been out, like they've had to deal with this and they already pre-planned that. So they've got this whole curve that they're planning on distributing this over time. But I don't think that I've seen an adequate plan of how they're going to absorb that over time. How that's, even if the game goes gangbusters in terms of people loving it and wanting to spend money on it and do things, they're not really showing away because everything's talking about holding, with like one weird exception around this sort of Web3 on the web NFT burning recipe system for other. It just sounds like this weird kind of thing that they have as a sort of plan to sort of burn NFTs or get rid of stuff or drive some sort of spending. And I've seen that sort of in late game models where they struggle with supply. Like many Rail Nations end up like fourth season doing that, where they're like asking people to do all these different kinds of burning NFTs to try and reduce the supply because it was out of control. I could see that desperate kind of bonfire move going here, but you'd have to really incentivize people strongly because you have the situation where investors are going to be at some point dumping these tokens onto the market, and then players are going to be doing the same, and then people that staked and get staking rewards are going to be doing the same. Everyone's dumping them onto the market. Who's going to be scooping those up, and where are those going to be going? I don't think it's been adequately answered for me to not be skeptical that this is not a great plan so far.
Yeah, it sounds risky, and it sounds like maybe there haven't been that many lessons learned from these types of single token models from the past. Okay, let's talk about the security. Oh, and actually, before we get into the security element, you actually looked at the price, and obviously caveat this with the fact that obviously the game isn't live yet, the game isn't broadly distributed yet, so of course there's going to be downward pricing pressure, unless you're speculating. I mean, you could argue that it should be going up, in fact, before launch, because the more hype there is, the more people want to buy into it. But tell us a little bit about what you found by when you looked at the pricing moves over time for the GOG token.
Yeah, like most things that came out in 2021, 2022, and then like the market just kind of crashed, they pretty much just went down to a sort of idle value where it just sits there around a certain value that may or may not be its true value. It's hard to say, right? Because we don't really know how to price these things yet. And when it's a game that's not even live yet, what are you trading it based off of? It's just pure speculation. And if there's no speculation happening, the price isn't going to move, which is exactly what's happening with most of the tokens out there, because there's no reason for it to move. People still might be trading it, but it's not going to be heavy. Now, obviously, like it started getting a little bit of movement around the pivot and the fact that this is impending and coming. So I do imagine like we'll start to see a little more volatility in it, whether that be up or down. I can't say for sure because, again, they left a lot of stuff vague. And I think, again, that was on purpose. And it's probably smart, prudent at this point to be a little bit vague because that's game design. You can't really pre-plan everything and expect it to all go according to plan. Obviously, you want that to be a lot of it happening in the studio level and not in public, but they're in that point where they've already made a lot of public promises they have to keep at least partially. And so I imagine at first it might not be too bad for the token. And I'm just totally speculating here and not really, this is no investment advice of any kind. But there may be some positive interest in the token at first, only because the supply is going to be lower right now. Like the full distribution hasn't hit. People might be thinking, oh, this game takes off. Like I could take advantage of that with the token. And so you might get some speculation there only because the market right now is very back into speculating on crypto. And so that could definitely lean into that. Obviously, there's not a ton of uses for the token yet. People, I'm not sure if people can stake at the moment. I'm not sure if they have those staking live, but if so, people could scoop it up to just stake it all in there, which just means you get a dump later on and a big price crash. But it really depends on how much they have active, I think, when the game goes full launch, how much you could do with this token. They've got to deal with even just launching onto a new blockchain and then dealing with all that migration stuff. And I imagine they're hoping for maybe some Web2 success first before worrying so much about the Web3, but they still got a, you know, plenty of investment on that Web3 side. Like essentially player investors they've got to answer to amongst like private investors that they actually took money from.
Yeah. A lot to think about there. The automated gameplay, let's get onto the security aspect here. I had the pixels.xyz founder on the pod, I think last episode or the episode but one. And we spent probably about a third of the episode talking about anti-bot detection, fighting bots. And whenever you have something that accrues value, we know this even from Web2 games, gold farming, and we just talked about Zynga Poker before this call and how there's a gray economy around those as well, the chips there. So whenever you've got something that accrues value in games, whether it be real value, especially when it's real value, you're going to have bots, you're going to have bad actors coming in. Now, maybe that's not a problem yet because, again, there's not a huge amount of value accruing to this GOG token. But talk to me a little bit about what is your view on having an auto-battler type gameplay, which literally lends itself to bots, like it's as if by design, and the token itself.
Right. Obviously, the sort of idle genre, auto battle genre, whatever you want to call it, it's fairly popular. And that's beside a lot of market research and the white paper and things like that to justify the move as being a good one because it's a popular genre. But of course, as you rightly point out, there's no monetary value to be gained from actually having bots play that. So obviously there can be some if you're selling accounts, things like that, but that's a lot more difficult to make a bigger business out of. In this situation, depending on how they do the distribution of tokens and the value tokens and things like that, definitely could be a problem for them. We definitely saw most of the web, the sort of Gen 1 Web 3 games, in, depending on how we chop those up, but pretty much most of the games we've seen so far ended up with some sometimes very significant level of bots playing them. And it's in, we saw situations where games like Splinterlands tried to go, let's just make them good economic participants, things like that. And if you think about it, it makes sense where if you're treating a game like labor in some form, then automation comes in to try and automate labor, which is what we're seeing as a thing going on in the real world outside of games pretty frequently these days, especially with AI. And so it only makes more sense that would be the problem. And the question that came down in, a lot of times in 2021, 2022 is, what are the players doing of value that justifies them getting something of value? And that was, how are they adding value to the game so that you're giving something in return? Obviously, there's like, you know, competitive models and things like that. But if this is an auto battler, there's not really like much skill to be had. So it's hard to justify, like, hey, we're rewarding the most skillful players. They're talking about a model where they're rewarding off leaderboards and stuff. But if there, there certainly is some skill in terms of selecting the right characters and adapting, but considering there's not really a lot stopping you from net decking because there's no real interactivity, people just pick whatever the meta is, and therefore that's their skill. Unless they're keeping it secret, pretty much everyone could do it, and it's just who could spend the most to actually have those things. Similar to what you see sometimes in high-end trading card game stuff, where if the meta is expensive, then it's whoever could spend the most to actually have those decks will do the best. And that's like an unfortunate reality of it. And then when you tokenize that stuff on top of it, and you're talking about like essentially prize money or something that has monetary value, that's going to be very difficult for them to manage because there's no anti-bot technology that truly works. And there's no reason for there to be as AI is evolving quite quickly. And even more reason why it would be very difficult, unless you're having AI try and detect and block other AI, then maybe that sort of war could work out better than us trying to fight it. But that's, you know, it's not necessarily a solvable problem. And I do think it's better to just accommodate for it in the economy design. And I don't see that doing like a leaderboard model on an automated game is going to really do that. That was a big problem in one of the earlier experiments that I think was a decent experiment, which was like Mir 4 and Mir M. They just got overrun by bots, like super bot farms everywhere. And the only way it was sort of manageable for it, for the company was we made was basically to basically just charge $10 for those bots to be mining like per account and then just ban them in huge waves. And then charge them that $10 again. And it was like, this is financially viable for the company at least, because now they're just getting paid to do these bot wave bans. And that's like an old model that goes back to like the Something Awful forums for just banning people, get their 10 bucks again. But I don't think that helps the player base out. And I hope they have another answer for how they're going to distribute these tokens. Obviously, there's community rewards, which are a little easier to give to humans, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. As I mentioned, the Pixel.xyz founder, I think, a good third of that interview was because they now have hundreds of thousands of DAU, tens of thousands of concurrents. Their token is going up, a token go up. And so whenever you have that situation, you're going to have bad actors entering the economy, and you're going to have bots. Automation is going to be happening. And so, yeah, good luck to these guys. I think if anybody has the resources, I suppose Immutable does in the space, but it sounds like it's going to be a potentially an uphill battle. Okay, why don't we, before we go into the kind of TLDR, what are your views on the potential success or failure or middle of the ground for this game? How big is the market for auto battlers and even in Web 2? And then what sliver of that do you think is going to, if it's even knowable, is going to migrate to the Web 3 component?
Overall, the Web 3 market, like, in terms of player base, is not really that huge for like real like gamers, but there's this weird mix of like people that are not necessarily gamers that are interested in the space. But the problem is like we estimate a lot of the Web3 player base off of a mix of bots and people that are into it for the play to earn, and it's not really like gamers that they're trying to get to play the game. Gamers is, it's actually not that huge of a player base yet, but I think it's one of those things where we're like everyone's hoping to convert players, but if you think about it, like most like new business models don't really replace the old one. And like, they just extend it a little bit. Like arcades are still a business. Like they're not as great a business as they used to be. Arcades are still around, but every one of these business models, consoles still exist. Like they don't go away. They just shift in terms of like player base, things like that. Sometimes it's just new people being born that end up playing these things. And so in this case, like you're not going to convert a lot of Web 2 to Web 3, but you might get some people interested. Right now, there's like a lot of negativity to overcome it, and a lot of it rightfully earned. We just had SBF finally get slapped down, so at least we're getting some public punishment for some of these bad actors, but it's definitely still a problem. And I think it's going to be very hard sell to a lot of people. And I think most of the people that are going to be involved in the Web3 were the people that were already involved in the Web3 for this game. And then some of those even might be like, hey, I don't want to do it with an auto battler and just sell it off to someone else. So the question is, can they get enough people excited about it when they're also backing off from making it crucial to the game? And that's such a difficult needle to thread, because you're like, hey, we got to make Web3 matter so Web3 matters, but we also got to make it not matter so it doesn't matter to these people. And it's like, how do you make both player races happy? And you could just go the dramatic direction of like on-chain games and extremes, and like, this is a niche audience, we don't care. And I think that works for that. But like the rest of it, it's going to be very difficult. And I don't think going to an auto battler necessarily did them any favors in that sense, because you've already got these people running this bot mentality sometimes in Web3 anyways, that it's just going to be them almost like competing with the Web2 people in a way that might end up making the Web2 people just demotivated because they're not really interested in the Web3 part that is outpacing them on the leaderboards, or just like spending to win the way pay-to-win games sometimes really make the free-to-play players or the sort of dolphins disinterested in playing because they can't spend that level.
So many of these games that are trying to balance Web2 and Web3, you put it nicely there, actually. They need to make Web3 matter so that Web3 matters. but at the same time, they need to appeal to a large enough audience, meaning Web2, because everybody recognizes that this Web3 player base just is not big enough in and of itself. There just aren't enough people, I think, who really care about owning NFTs, like, or digital ownership at this point in time. Maybe that'll change over time. Maybe there'll be new kids being born into it. Skins in Fortnite are a very big business. UGC content is a big business, and it's mostly skews younger, right? But yeah, I think converting that Web2 audience, I think we've seen enough. We've had enough years of enough shots on goal by enough companies that have had enough funding and enough experience on their teams not succeed with that yet. I'll caveat that with a yet, that it is an uphill battle, I think. Okay. Let's, with all that said, with all of this preamble, what is your view, Devin, of how Guild of Guardians, what are its chances? Pros and cons.
So the hard part is, if I just completely ignore the Web3 side of things and just focus on the Web2 side, I think it's tricky in the sense that it's not totally original in a lot of ways. The core design is not terrible. Like a squad-based auto battler is fine. There's a lot of those. They seem to work okay. They've got a sort of roguelite way of looking at the dungeon and like essentially procedurally generating content. But the question is, what's the hook to really make it interesting? When you read the white paper, it just sounds like this blueprint for grinding, which from an economy design, that makes sense. But if that's really what the game comes down to, over time, that kind of becomes not that interesting without an IP tied to it. Like I watched like something like a Street Fighter duel game, right? That was this gotcha grind fest kind of game. And people that are into Street Fighter are interested in it for a while, but the people, it's not going to sustain as a game that's fun in and of itself without that IP attached to it. In this case, Guild of Guardians is relatively generic fantasy. And that's not really, that being said, people could still get excited about the game for the Web3 side of things and build up like a player base around that sort of play to earn like enthusiasm that probably isn't sustainable. But I think like some people are hoping that this flywheel kind of effect, as they like to call it, which I think is selling it probably a bit more than it usually is, getting that initial sort of network effect going. They might be able to do that if we're in a bull market right now and people are excited and flooding from especially other countries into just jumping into that hopeful play to earn, even if it's not realistic. That might help it get going. But that being said, this is not really a super multiplayer game to where that's going to like provide a lot of network effect to get people playing, because it's still semi-single player content from what I can tell. There might be some PvP, but that doesn't seem like the core of the game. So I don't know. If they could find like a real, I think a niche audience and grow from there, they probably have more potential than trying to mass market this. I don't really see, we're not in a place right now where you could just launch a new mobile game and mass market it without a lot of luck and a lot of money. And that's why you see even the companies that know how to do it stopping releasing games. They're just like, we can't even do it. So it makes you think you could do it, because the one advantage is the Web3 side. And that's the side they're basically semi-copping out on to compromise for that. So it's a big ask at that point.
Yeah. We wish them good luck, and I wish Bobby Ferguson good luck on the January 24th episode, and he is very excited, and he acknowledged actually on that show that they have a lot of titles launching over the next year or two, and he fully expects most of them to be failures in a kind of commercial sense, and that's games for you. But his hope and I think expectation certainly was for there to be that 10-20% of games that launched that actually will have that. And he believes there will be a mass market audience for them. So we wish them luck. And Web3 certainly needs that at this moment in time. But with that, I do think we need to, so we said at the start, we're going to take a little beat here, a little pause, and look at where are we with Web3, because we are right smack in the middle of yet another crypto bull run, right? And that's what launched Web3 last time around, was a big crypto bull run, right? So what have we learned in the interim? And what are our expectations for what this crypto bull run is going to do? Are some of the business models that we're seeing emerge this year, are they any different to what they were in 2021? Have we learned any lessons? Are we in the middle of another tulip mania? Is play to earn actually sustainable? Can you build a real play to earn game? Again, if you listen to the pixels.xyz episode, they're very bullish, to bring back that word again from 2021. They're very bullish on play to earn, and they're leaning into play to earn. They're truly saying that we are a play to earn game. We believe we can control value creation. We believe that token price can go up essentially indefinitely. Let's see if that holds true. But with that, I want to just, Devin and I are just going to talk a little bit about where are we in this market and how do we think this is going to play out differently compared to last time. So a lot to unpack there. So why don't we start with Devin, because your view is like, we're the crypto bull. That's what launched the last Web3 wave. Are we going to see the same thing happen this time? And if so, how is it going to be different?
Like this is what I've been saying during the entire sort of like short winter we had, was that basically the Western markets will be interested as soon as there's money to be made. And that's exactly what happens, is we had the ETFs happen and there was money to be made. And now here we are interested again. I don't know if I'd call this a bull market for games though, because if we're talking about what really kicked this off was Bitcoin ETFs, that doesn't really have a lot of relevance to games as much as we like to, outside of something like Zebedee, where there's a tie directly to Bitcoin. And I don't think Bitcoin ordinals really count for this as something that's really game tied. And so that makes it questionable. Obviously, Ethereum goes up with Bitcoin, and that's where it starts to impact the games, because as Ethereum goes up, that's where the games are generally run on in some form or another, in a way, like whether that be layer twos or tangential stuff or stuff that's similar to it. And so obviously there's investment coming in, and so that kind of perpetuates that cycle, at least for a while longer, right? Where you're seeing more money come in, but you had a lot of failures in the beginning, where there's a lot of people that just silently failed. And then you have some of these games that are just not even released yet getting re-upped. They're getting extended investments, essentially. And it's, is this just a, let's double down on our potential losses? Or is it like, we really believe this is going to happen? Or we have to, for the sake of our company, really believe this is going to happen? And I think right now, I haven't seen any thesis on why this is different or better, other than it's different and better this time. And the fact that people are still championing play to earn without really justifying why it's different is... it leaves me pretty skeptical that this is like a long-lasting bull run. I feel like this is a sort of, let's just get money going again and hope for the best, wishful thinking. I'm still bullish on more of the Asian market, not caring so much about this being a money play and more of an actual like exciting technology and design thing to be the real carrier forward. And that this might unfortunately be short-lived, but I would love for this to be last indefinitely. But I got to be realistic. I haven't seen any reason to believe that yet.
It strikes me that there are maybe three or four buckets of Web3 development going on. So there's your absolute purists who are all on-chain stuff. Like they're doing it because they believe that is a type of gameplay that needs to exist. And there is a big enough audience. They recognize mostly that it's a relatively small audience, but a big enough audience that's prepared to spend significant amounts of money, real money, and for that to be a thing. So fully on-chain games. Then you've got the kind of the middle, mostly, and this is where most developers fall, is that middle Web 2.5, where they're trying to straddle the Web 2 and Web 3. They're trying to be on mobile because that's where the players are on Web 2. But then there's this extra value creation from Web 3. Let's see if there are any successful examples of that coming out. And then you've got the rebirth of play to earn, which is, no, we truly believe that there is this type of gameplay where I'm grinding for tokens and those tokens will accrue value because there'll be more players and more participants in the ecosystem and the economy coming in than are taking value out. And those are the three buckets. And then there's this hybrid Asian bucket, I think, which is, as you point out, they're really interested in the technology and they think that technology can actually apply to games. And it's not really called even Web3 so much there. It's a feature, right? It's a feature or it's a set of technologies that can be applied to game design but not for financial reasons and not necessarily for tokenization. Would that be a fair assessment of where we are right now? And maybe talk a little bit about each of those buckets in terms of how you see those evolving and who are the interesting players in those three or four buckets?
Yeah, in the side of the on-chain game sort of thing, I think of it similar to a lot of other emerging technologies that don't really take off as a game platform immediately, like VR, for example, is in Weird Spiral, right? Where clearly there's potential. No one, like, I think, like discounts that there's potential. Some games could be amazing with it. There's really cool things you could do, but clearly the market's not there. The technology, maybe there's, you know, something just lacking in terms of getting people to really adopt it. So a lot of it's comfort and sort of technology needing to actually advance enough to make things more comfortable. And I mean, you even see that with like Apple's headset, where people are just like, this thing's just too heavy. It's like wearing a helmet all day. Those kinds of problems like are not solved overnight. And the on-chain stuff is the same kind of thing. There's just a lot of hurdles and problematic things. I think it gets there eventually to some extent, right? It's a cool technology. I think we know some cool things you could do with it that are amazing. I think some of the stuff like David Amore is talking about around these sort of ideas of composition are fantastic. But I think that's also a little futuristic for where we are right now. It's a little flying car for where we're at, where it's like, yeah, you could build it, but maybe it's not practical yet. But someone's got to do it, right? Someone's got to lay that groundwork. And I think I cheerlead those on-chain people all day long. I think that's awesome. I think what they're doing is amazing, but I don't see a commercial reality for that at the moment. And that's only just because it's early. And I would love for it to be otherwise, but even the technology of blockchain itself is early that they're building on and evolving. So expect that to shift. Now, as far as the sort of play-to-earn bucket, I think the easy way to look at it is you keep talking about these other people coming in to spend money, right? So then that, if you could balance that out, that's fine. But if you're just talking about kicking the can to the next player who's going to earn and kick the can to the next player, that's pretty much a Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme at that point, right? Like that's just hoping the next guy will fall for it. And that's where we ended up with a lot of art NFTs that fall in that the value of this is how much the next sucker will pay. And that's not real value. So if you're looking at it in terms of like two-tiered economy where there's players that are essentially the gold farmers and there's players that are willing to pay for that gold, as long as the bots don't ruin that, that has some potential for some sustainability, but that demand needs to be there. People need to be willing to buy that gold. People need to be willing for that to exist. There was, for example, some success from the Diablo 3 auction house. Blizzard didn't shut it down because it was a financial failure for them. They shut it down for a variety of other reasons, but there is like some potential for that to work, at least short term, right? But you have to have the demand there. And that everyone keeps talking about the supply side of like, hey, we'll control how many tokens people get. Yeah, but can you control how many tokens people buy? That's where the effort's not really being put. I find it ironic because it's like, we know how to get people to spend money because free-to-play has been doing it and like turning it into a science for the last decade plus. I think we've got some ideas on how to get people to spend money, but they do it in this weird roundabout ways instead of just selling people stuff. And I don't know if that's really a good business model. And so they got to find somebody to make that work.
If you think about what that model actually is in real life, you're flipping things on its head, right? You're not actually, you're just starting with the, hey, you can make money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there was a great New York Times article just last week, which was all about how the crypto bull has brought back internet cafes in the Philippines, where people are going once again, just like they did during the Axie days in, you know, 2020, 2021, and are essentially just grinding for tokens that have some economic value. And actually Pixels.xyz, my guest from last week or last episode, was mentioned by name in there. And that's what folks are playing. They're playing these games, they're earning tokens, and they're cashing them out. And there's enough demand because token go up that you're always going to find those people. But you're then going searching. It's really interesting because you're like, hey, you can make money. Great. Everybody wants to make money. Of course, that's something that people will do for sure. It doesn't matter how awful the user experience is. If there's money to be made, they're going to go and try and make money. But then they wait to try and figure out like who's going to be buying these tokens other than future speculators. And I think that's just that's been always in my mind, the biggest problem in the play to earn space. It starts with a financial motive. And it then goes in search of the, I want to spend on something for the pure joy of spending on that thing because I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
That's just how, give me any example in the history of human invention where that has worked out. I would struggle to think of something like that, where you go in with the profit motive and then you try to backfill.
That's most of tech, right? Yeah. We'll get a ton of investment. We'll figure out how to make money later.
Well,
so that worked for tech.
But I would, they start with, we want to create we're going to make a product that people will want. They're still starting right. With the demand
they
side.
Start with They're market not with the supply share side. Is the goal.
Basically. Right, exactly. And market share is the goal. They want to make a product that like everybody wants so much that eventually It'll start to make money. And here, it's it never starts that way. It starts with the financial. It starts with like, hey, I want to be able to make money and I want people to make money, but I'm not going to figure out why they would want to spend on it.
Just sell stuff to people in the game that allow people to trade it. Like, you're actually making less money by asking people to trade your thing than just selling it to people, because you're not selling it to people. The other people are selling it to people. And you're actually kneecapping yourself if you haven't figured out how to make sure that's going to work for you long term. And it seems, like you said, pretty backwards. I don't think it's like unsolvable. I just think people are, the way I've been putting it lately is, I think people look at all these weird obfuscated token systems and other
bonding
stuff
like curves and
as a cheat code for, we'll figure out how to make,
we'll figure it out at some point. We're gonna put out a long ass white paper. So no, I think that's, and the word tokenomics is making a comeback as well. I've noticed more and more in the pitches that we get for guests to come onto the podcast. Oh, we have the best tokenomics, like we've figured out a formula.
Please do tell.
Don't keep it a secret. You give it to all of us too. Yeah. Okay, so I think we seem to have a similar view of the play to earn. I'm more than happy to have guests on the show, by the way, and I'm more than happy to always be proven wrong. I think we both are, like, we're
intellectually curious people.
It's hard
to just come on and be like, hey, we're going to make the, you'd want to spend
here's,
the
here's how
this
it's going to work. But so far, I have yet to be convinced by any of our guests or by anything I've seen that you can make play to earn work in any other form other than during a crypto bull, when all the prices are going up in tandem and everybody thinks they can make money and leave somebody else holding the bag, right?
Like, I think that's can in a pay to win sort of place where that's okay. I think that's why I think Asian markets are a little more suited for this stuff, because if pay to win's acceptable in the player base, it becomes a little more viable, I think, personally.
Yeah, and why don't we talk about that bucket then? Because that's, and we'll save the Web 2.5 bucket for last. I think I know what you're going to say about that. But let's talk a little bit about the Asian bucket, because I think that is under-discussed, certainly on this podcast. And I do hear from many guests who have exposure to those markets that the technology is further along, or the use of the technology is further along, and it's much more accepted, but it's not accepted for the reasons that we typically talk about here, which is either play to earn or some kind of NFT ownership that's the holy grail of monetization in a Web2 game, right? Which we'll talk about that in a second. What is differentiating the Asian markets as it relates to blockchain technologies that are being used in games?
I mean, there's definitely still lagging play to earn. The vibe that came on from the games that were developed earlier on when play to earn was like more of a thing. And I think that's still considered acceptable. And I think knowing that's not going to last forever, like people just ride it out and then the game will be on and then whatever, they'll move on to the next game. And I found talking to like South Korean developers during Korea Blockchain Week, things like that, that Korea could be like that, where there could just be one hit game for a very short period of time that everyone's playing and then it just gets replaced. And that's okay there because they have a very kind of different market. Whereas Japan specifically has been very bullish, not on crypto per se, but on NFTs, to the point where the government was like, NFTs are going to be great, which you don't hear from most governments, especially South Korea, which is like, hey, don't touch crypto and games. Like, they just don't want you to do it. And so I think Japan has been very pro about that. And obviously they have a lot of other financial issues going on with their government right now that they're trying to deal with. And I think maybe they're hoping that that's part of what helps. But that's one of the places where you have the most AAA companies like in the space, where they're like willing to experiment, willing to try stuff out and see what works. And I think they actually do believe, and I think a lot of people are skeptical that the developers are often greedy. And I think more often than not, developers don't start out greedy unless they're in like jumping into a space where everyone's just greedy already. And I think a lot of times the people that are like developers that are like, player ownership's really cool, actually mean it. Like, they think player ownership's really cool, or players being able to trade's really cool. And it was very difficult to deal with that before, you know, as you saw with Blizzard and Diablo. And Valve even, I think, is a great example, because they've had to figure out how to navigate that with their marketplace. And so Asia's just like, hey, this is a cool thing. We want players to be able to do this. We think this is going to be fun for the games and interesting. Let's figure out how to make it work. And obviously they experiment in different ways. Like the Symbiogenesis experiment from Square Enix is very kind of off the wall, this sort of weird Where's Waldo narrative adventure it's very different and experimental. And I think that's where they're not looking at it as a Ponzi scheme. How can we make this even harder to understand white paper? We're just going to try some stuff and keep building up and figure out what works and get there hopefully eventually. But I think focusing on the NFTs is probably the smarter approach, because that's thought of for a reason as less about play to earn, because the NFTs don't have this simple fungible monetary value. And I think that helps a lot in obfuscating that on purpose.
Okay. So let's talk then about what is probably the biggest bucket, certainly in the Western market, certainly in the US market, which is this straddling the Web 2 and Web 3 world. Some people call it Web 2.5. Some people call it play and earn. Some people call it play and win. There are a lot of euphemisms for what is essentially a somewhat of a financialization of a game, right? Talk to me a little bit about, have you seen any examples, recent examples in particular, of people doing it well? Because again, it's not that it can't work. It's just that it hasn't worked yet. And I think it's just, it'll be interesting to see if somebody cracks the code, who is in your mind closest to cracking that code and what are they doing that's perhaps different to what most others have done, which is we're going to slap some NFTs in there for the whales. And then we're going to have potentially a tokenized economy or some kind of token that's attached to this game for somewhat some financial speculation. That's typically, if I'm being a bit brutal, that's typically how that works out in a nutshell for most of these games, just different genres.
And I think it's difficult to find good examples of using the token. Although I do think, for example, the Mirror games, they weren't great games in and of themselves, and that was part of the problem. I think they did interesting things with the tokens where that made sense to integrate into the economy around being a sort of resource for trading in and out of the game to a specific crafting resource that had a purpose in the game. And I'm talking specifically about Mirror M because I wasn't playing Mirror 4 back when that first started, so I don't know how that changed over time necessarily, but Mirror M was designed with this idea of this crafting material can be converted into, you know, something you could sell on blockchain, and then that allows whales to also be able to buy that resource without having to mine it themselves, and that just helps them. And that made some sense, right? Like, I don't think it necessarily executed flawlessly, but the concept wasn't terrible. And the governance token they introduced actually had governance stuff around servers and taking control of servers and things like that. And again, not perfect execution, but an interesting idea. And then you look at like the Western market, I think something like NFL Rivals was a perfectly fine model. It was like, hey, there's this gotcha stuff. And if there's stuff that you have that you want to trade to other people, you can do so. And then they can do so. And then we're actually going to profit a little bit from that. And everyone wins because it's not going to break the game because we haven't designed this to be a system where that matters that much. But it's still honestly still a little pay to win, right? Like, because you're able to buy these sort of players from outside and then bring them in, and that can affect your ability to play well. And I have a couple that I bought when the game first came out, like when it was very first launched. I don't know if it was in beta or not, but and I still get emails all the time about like my NFTs that are on the market because I put them on the market just to see. And I do see the price going up and down, but it actually seems to actually sustain at a relatively decent price for stuff that I just got out of a few dollar, because they were actually giving NFTs out of the gotcha boxes at the beginnings before, and that allowed me to see it in action, and it seems to be fine because it's not game breaking. But again, that's where if pay to win is like a little more acceptable, then you're allowing outside trading, and then the whales can now buy their way to like progress of some kind or winning. And if you're okay with that, that's fine. Now, the other side of it is you could go to the just fully cosmetic route, and I can just give a quick example of like CSGO, right? Where that's, it's a closed ecosystem, so it's not quite Web3, but it's still basically Web3 in a, as if it was an isolated blockchain, where there's just no bridging out. And so people have been trading that stuff for a long time. That's not
a that works because the game itself is, again, they start, all these examples are essentially, with the possible exception of NFL Go from, was it Mythical Games? Right? We actually had John Linden on the pod last year. But there's a CSGO in particular is an example of a game that is so good and has such a dedicated player base already that you can essentially have this closed ecosystem on top. And if they launched their own blockchain, like, it probably would work, right? Like, they literally could probably do that. I'm just curious, that straddling of the Web 2 and Web 3, where you're deliberately trying to say, hey, we are trying to incorporate these elements, instead of first making something amazing and then probably backing into blockchain technologies, backing into digital ownership, backing into potentially some kind of trading or value transfer between players inside the ecosystem because they want to be there in the first place. That's what I'm getting at here. Like, have you seen examples of that really working in this space so far?
No, because it's just not a great plan to do it that way. I think at the end of the day, if people are paying money for something, you can't justify the value of that something, that's not a good idea. If you could be like, yeah, it's worth this because it's like it does this in the game, or people want it because of this, that's not just a speculative reason. That's, it's not a hard answer. Like, it's just make it valuable and people will buy it. And I think that's been the history of purchases in games. It's not that hard, but it is that hard, right? Like, to actually execute on that. But it's not a hard concept to understand, of just make some value and then sell that value. And in this case, you're involving the player base in part of that. Like, the skins example was totally play to earn. you don't pay for skins in CSGO. You just get them randomly. I have some that have been just popped out. It was like worth like $30. Whatever. Like just, and that's for the box. That's not even like opening it yet. But they also found a way to monetize it. That was like, hey, we're going to charge you $2 for a key. And therefore, we're monetizing the thing that we're giving you for free. And you could sell it back and forth all day long. And we're going to get a marketplace fee. So they enforce royalties on the trading for their skins. So it's, again, it was not a hard system. Like you said, they had value and they gave out something as part of that value that didn't break the game. And obviously, they had a whole lot of other legal stuff they dealt with. And I think that was a good precursor to some of the stuff we might have to deal with if Web3 is successful. We have a lot of barriers we have yet to run headlong into that I think Valve pointed to the point where you can't even trade keys anymore. They shut that down a while ago because it was like, hey, people are using that for money laundering. So what do you think we're going to see happen if Web3 becomes popular? I think you're going to see that argument quite frequently.
Yeah. All right. So final parting thoughts here from you. What do you think is going to happen in 2024 now that the crypto bull is raging once again? Mostly, I think most people attribute it, as you yourself put it, to Bitcoin ETFs starting trading. And so just making it a bit more accessible to get access to crypto. At some point, you would presume that would settle down once the kind of markets calibrate and reach an equilibrium. Obviously, there's going to be speculation always. What does that mean for Web3 gaming? Right. Let's assume the crypto bull keeps going throughout this year. What is that going to do for Web3 gaming? And are we going to do things differently this time around compared to 2021, where everybody really mostly was just chasing a quick buck? Right. That's if you're going to be brutal about it, that's not, I don't think, unfair to say. Your thoughts?
I think in general, and this is maybe a little bit of wishful thinking, that VCs are going to be a little bit more due diligence this time and a little bit more thinking, how can we make this work? But at the end of the day, they also aren't necessarily incentivized to make games successful. They're incentivized for their return, which means like even if that blows up the game, like that's still part of their business model. And so it is a little tricky, right? Because I think generally the hope is that they're going to fund good games and that those good games will then become successful games. But I think generally if we're looking at it as token models being paid for by VCs, the chance of them not being great ideas are pretty high, unfortunately. And I think we might be able to see some good games potentially get funded this phase just because there will be some people who learned from last time. But so far, the indications are that money needs to be spent somewhere and that if someone has an idea that passes enough of a smell test, they'll go with it. And even some reinvesting in games that haven't really proven anything yet. So I'm hopeful that at least one good game comes out of it. But I think at this point, like I'm still not even sure that's going to be the case because developing a good game itself is already hard. Doing that on the back of a token-based model is about 10 times as hard. I wish everyone the best luck, and I really am only skeptical because I want to point to the problems to make sure we solve them, not because I think they're unsolvable, but I do think that maybe we're also just running past them, chasing after the buck, and I definitely don't want to see that happen because I think Web3 is really cool technology, but also maybe we could think less about the money and more about what you could do with it and go towards that more Asian mindset.
Yeah, and I'm exactly the same. I think I do wish everybody the best of luck. Game development is hard as is, and creating any new product is hard, never mind games. And so innovators who embrace new technologies, we should celebrate them. We should salute them. And I certainly do, and it sounds like you do as well. But yeah, I think it is fair to point to the challenges that we face as developers. And sometimes maybe those challenges, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze kind of thing at the end of the day? That's really what I think we should be asking ourselves. Is the juice worth the squeeze for integrating all of these complicated technologies and challenging user experience hurdles that we're introducing? Because we're introducing more friction essentially through Web3. And so we should always remember that the juice needs to be worth the squeeze. Okay, I always ask our guests, and I've already asked you this question, but I want to see if you have a different answer. What are your favorite three games that you're playing at the moment, or the three games or any games that you're most excited by?
Yeah, I don't know if I have to start with Web3 games or not, because I definitely did get on the Helldivers 2 and the Bellatro kick, and I never really truly got sick of Marvel Snap, so that's still constantly in there. And I did really want to get into Warzone Mobile, but that really just did not click at all. I did try, and the Web3 side, I tried to get a bit into Shrapnel and play some of that stuff, but it's still pretty early, and I think that's the case for a lot of these Web3 games where I'm like excited about them for where they're going more than where they are right now, which is, you know, I think Shrapnel and Metalcore and a lot of these games like that I think that look really cool I'm excited for, but I also think they're a little ways off right now. And middle quarter seems maybe a little closer, but I think the one I'm still the most excited about, and this was the top one in that sort of Web3 games I was looking forward to, which is the Off the Grid, which I think they did it in a way that makes me think that they actually have something, you know, worth playing. But that being said, I obviously haven't played it hands-on, but I am excited about that one the most because I think they showed, it was probably scripted, but still what looked like actually good potential gameplay, and they don't seem to be pushing Web3 first in it. They seem to be pushing like, hey, there's all this cool game stuff like we're doing. I don't know if they can pull it off because it looks pretty ambitious, but I'm hopeful that's going to be the one I'm, when you ask me this question next, just grinding that.
Nice. All right. That, and I love the fact that you still have optimism for Web3 and you're excited to try Web3 games. I think we all should be. We should all be interested in this industry to see innovation happen, like I said. And there's definitely innovation happening in this space. There's some chasing the buck, but there's definitely some innovation too. Okay. That is a great place, I think, to end today. Devin, thank you so much for coming on the pod as always.
Thank you.
Real pleasure. And it was a lot of fun talking with you about our unvarnished thoughts about where this industry is headed and what we could potentially expect in 2024. So thank you.
Absolutely.
And a big thank you, as always, to all of our listeners. We'll be back next week with more interviews, more insights, and more analysis from the weird and wonderful world of Web3. So until next time, friends, stay crypto curious and feel free to send questions, guest recommendations, and comments to me. My email is nico@navik.co.
If you enjoyed today's episode, whether on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, make sure to like, subscribe, comment, or give a 5-star review. And if you want to reach out or provide feedback, shoot us a note at podcast@navik.co or find us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Plus, if you want to learn more about what Navik has to offer, make sure to check out our website, www.navik.co. There, you can sign up for the number one games industry newsletter, Navik Digest, or contact us to learn about our wide-ranging consulting and advisory services. Again, that is www.navik.co. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.